This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
Bob Costas is with us here on Sports Byline. Bob, I was thinking about your book that you wrote back in 2000 called Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. When you reflect back to when you wrote about the game at that time and now think about where we are today with the game, how much has changed positive and how much has changed negative about baseball in your mind?
Well, the steroid thing has come to a head, although it was known at that time. Anyone with his or her eyes open from the mid-90s on could see that something was fishy. And as you may recall, I started talking about this on the air, on the World Series, the All-Star Game, and on other programs like yours, as early as 1996, 97, and I was hammering it pretty hard by the year 2000. And now that has come to a head, and there is no escaping it. I think circumstances have improved in a number of ways in that they avoided another work stoppage, so there's more distance between baseball fans and the horrible events of 94 and 95. And while they didn't fully reform the economics of the game, they took some steps in the direction that I was talking about in my book and later the commissioner's Blue Ribbon panel suggested. There is greater revenue sharing, and while they don't have a salary cap, the luxury tax acts as a de facto salary cap for almost every team. It doesn't really deter the Yankees very much, and the Red Sox look like they'll go past it on a fairly consistent basis, though not by as nearly as much as the Yankees do. But the other teams basically stay well beneath that luxury tax threshold. And in combination with revenue sharing and with teams doing a better cost-benefit analysis, the Oakland A's model has educated a lot of teams as to where it's smart to put your money and where you might do better saving it. I think that's accordioned the difference between most, let's say, the high middle teams and the lower market teams. But there's nothing you can do at this point about the Yankees. They're still running away from the pack. The new developments haven't curtailed them very much.
You know, a lot of people talk about the performance-enhancing drugs and maybe that being cheating, but hasn't baseball always been touched in some way by some sort of cheating? We're talking about spitballs, doctored balls, cork bats.
Yeah, that's more in the area of gamesmanship, and if you were caught, then supposedly you would be ejected or there would be some penalty. I think the steroid thing is far more significant and far darker. It's pretty clear to me that a substantial percentage of ball players, perhaps approaching 50%, have used some kind of performance-enhancing drug. Now, were they anabolic steroids in every case? No. Could have been human growth hormone, could have been androstenedione, a testosterone precursor, some combination of those things. But something has been very fishy, and the game that relies more than any other on its history and records has seen that history and those records be distorted in the last decade, and there's no way to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah. What do you do about somebody like a Barry Bonds? I think you and I probably agree that he probably will never be given his due as far as what he's been able to accomplish. Because
yeah, but what is his due, Ron?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
You know what? Is his due a one-for-one comparison between his numbers and those of Hank Aaron or Babe Ruth or Willie Mays? Or is it his due that he will always be viewed with a certain amount of skepticism? Maybe that's just rewards.
I also think, Bob, that that's probably a reflection of our time because obviously Hank Aaron was not scrutinized in the way because the media did not exist to the extent that it does today.
Yeah, but if they scrutinized Hank Aaron, they wouldn't have found performance-enhancing drugs. They would have found pure athletic ability and strength of character.
No, I agree with you, but I also think, too, that there's a cynicism about him because of his personality and the way, and I'm not trying to defend the man because he's been a pain in the rear end with me at times as well, but I think that there's always going to be a cloud over him just because of the demeanor of the man.
Well, I agree with you to a certain extent. For example, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa in 98 not only did a great thing statistically, but the way in which they carried themselves and represented the game was something that that a lot of people found appealing.
Right.
Plus, there's an important distinction here. I don't know about Sammy Sosa, what the future may show about Sammy Sosa, but when Mark McGwire used androstenedione, not only did baseball have anabolic steroids, but androstenedione you could buy over the counter at the GNC. And then when a controversy kicked up about it, Mark, at least according to his own testimony, renounced its use, said kids don't do this, and got off the stuff. So I think that the combination of the circumstances surrounding Mark McGwire and the fact that he's generally a well-liked guy cuts him a good deal more slack. Now you go to Bonds. The point you made about Bonds being very difficult with the press, being surly sometimes, he's not going to get the benefit of the doubt. But in this case, there's less and less doubt to give him the benefit of anyway. There's legitimately more scrutiny on him than anybody else because he might be, at least based on his achievements of the last 3-4 years, he might be the greatest player who ever played, including Babe Ruth. So naturally, the spotlight goes to the top. He's the single-season home run leader. He will soon be the all-time home run leader. And his body has changed in an extremely unnatural way over the last few years. I mean, forget about his body. Look at his head. How does your head suddenly expand in size in your mid and late 30s? So I think even if this guy had conducted himself like Mother Teresa in terms of his personality and community involvement, there would still be legitimate baseball questions about him.
Let's switch gears for just a second. Over the years, Bob, at least in the last, I would say, 6 to 7 years, I've noted a growing hostility between the fans and athletes.
Yeah.
I really think that part of it is due over the jealousy, the misunderstanding of how much the athletes are making, the anger over that, not realizing that an athlete is going to make as much as somebody is willing to pay him.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we had the fight in Detroit, which was the worst fight between athlete and fan that I had seen, I think, maybe ever. And then that was followed shortly thereafter by a fight between two teams in South Carolina and Clemson. What's your read as far as the relationship between fan and athlete today?
Well, I really think, Ron, that the vast, vast majority of fans no longer resent the salaries based on the pure amount of dollars. They do resent real or perceived attitudes. They resent in anyone a sense of entitlement or someone who isn't upholding their end of the deal in return for huge riches. But they expect that athletes will make large amounts of money, and in many cases they're sophisticated enough to understand that the athletes deserve it. But there is some resentment of the attitudes of many athletes rather than their paychecks. On top of that, there's a whole atmosphere that has been created in this culture that sports is a prominent part of, but it's not the only aspect of. It's the whole sports talk radio mentality, or talk radio in general. Look at the tone of politics. No one disagrees based on issues and has a civil and honorable disagreement anymore. It's all personal ad hominem attacks. Look at the tone in chat rooms and in blogs on the internet. Look at reality television, which encourages people to act like idiots and exhibitionists and calls on the most mean-spirited and least worthy aspects, in most cases, of human character. All of that is kind of part of an ongoing stew of things, of factors, a witch's brew of things that come to a head when you throw in alcohol and when you throw in the belligerent and exhibitionistic behavior of many athletes, when you throw in the public address system in many arenas and stadiums, which exhorts fans to act like buffoons, shows them on the Jumbotron, but only if they act like idiots. Television directors happy to focus on every single guy with his shirt off, acting like the biggest moron at a fraternity mixer, you know, with his shirt off 10 degrees below zero at Lambeau Field. It's a culture that rewards, at least in terms of attention, rewards idiotic, belligerent, antisocial behavior. And then it all comes to a head. Have I made myself clear?
I think you've been very explicit about your feelings on that, Bob. I can see you get exercised about it a little bit as much as I do. And yet, as I listen to you, I wondered to myself, is it only going to get worse, do you think, Bob? Or do you think the pendulum will come back to a middle ground? Do you think some reason will come into play on all of this, or what?
You know, I hope so. And yet,
yeah, I do too.
You have to be skeptical because it's like this. Whenever you watch a sportscast and something tragic has happened, someone has died or has a tragic illness, almost invariably the sportscaster says, well, you know, that really puts it all in perspective, which is completely inane because while it is a tragic story, I don't need someone's death or misfortune to help me put the Pepperdine Santa Clara game in perspective. I've got it in perspective to begin with. Now, as soon as the commercial runs and our resident nitwit comes back behind his or her microphone, they will then be screaming at multiple decibels about who the Seahawks should take in the third round and about how the coach is an idiot and the manager should be fired. So the perspective seems to fade very, very quickly. And the perspective that we may have gained after the Detroit-Indiana brawl or the South Carolina-Clemson brawl the next day, you know, it keeps cable TV humming for a while and talk radio humming for a while, and maybe a small percentage of people involved in sports really will learn their lesson, but I doubt it.
Let me switch gears because it's a natural transition to what I wanted to talk about next. You went to Syracuse University when you began your career in broadcasting. You were very successful at a very young age, but one of the things I've always respected and admired you for is that as young as you were, it was like the clock had been pushed ahead for you. You had a perspective. You had an understanding. You had an appreciation for the various aspects of sports. And not a lot of us in sports broadcasting have that, especially the young talent. As I go around the country, I lament the fact that I'll listen to radio or even television, but talk radio, and nobody seems to work with our young talent anymore. Let me take you back to Syracuse for a second. What was the credo on sports broadcasting? What were they trying to teach you at Syracuse?
Well, at that time, there are now many, many hundreds of programs in colleges and universities around the country dealing with broadcasting, public communications. Then Syracuse was among only a handful of schools that had formalized programs in that area, and a disproportionate number of the brightest students who were interested in that kind of thing gravitated towards Syracuse and a few other schools. And what I liked about it was that it was a great combination of what was then the modern in the early 70s and kind of the standard of the previous generations. We still had great respect, even reverence, for the broadcasters who had preceded us, but it was a different era. It was more of an anti-establishment era, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the counterculture. And so somehow most of us were able to blend an irreverent personal point of view with a respect for the craft that should always be eternal. There's a certain level of craftsmanship and professionalism that you can always bring to bear, even as the content and the events themselves change. And I don't know if that's held up very well in the year 2004. I mean, there are a lot of people on the air now, present company excluded, but there are a lot of people on the air who aren't minimally capable in terms of just the basic craftsmanship and the basic professionalism that you would expect them to bring to the job.
Do you think that the young sportscaster coming into the industry today, what are their shortcomings? We only got a couple minutes left, but what do you see as their shortcomings?
Well, I see a lot of talented people. The more outlets you have, the more opportunity for talented people to pop up on the landscape. And so I don't want to make it sound like it's a barren landscape. There are a lot of talented people. We need them. Many of them have different perspectives than you and I. They're younger. They have a different frame of reference, and that's all to the good. But I think among the drawbacks is the general idea of confusing shtick with style.
Yep.
You want to have a style. I don't like a shtick. Confusing bombast or turning up the volume with wit or personality. There isn't as much nuance or subtlety or real irony as opposed to people just posing. And the idea that the way you take the strongest possible stance is not to have an informed take on an issue, but just to fire a personal insult at a person or at a team. These kind of ad hominem attacks, passing for edginess, I think that's a real step backward.
Yeah, we only got about 45 seconds, but don't you think that the young sportscaster is trapped by the industry today, which wants that entertainment over substance?
Yeah, and the short attention span aspect. So we'd rather have a highlight than have an informed discussion of an issue, always.
What's the best piece of advice you'd give a young sportscaster then?
Learn the profession, learn the craft, have a respect for history, and try to understand the difference between personality and a shtick, and see where that takes you.
You have a lot of fun on the inside the NFL with those guys, don't you?
Yeah, and I think that's a good example, by the way. We're having fun, but it's not forced. It's not something that we're over the top with. And even as we look at the games and talk about what's going on in the games, there's room for journalism and commentary. I think it's a good combination of what you want it to be.
Bob, I want to thank you very much for your time. I always enjoy our conversation. Take care, and thank you for being a part of Sports Byline for so many years, Bob.
Always. always, Ron. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Take care. Bob Costas, of course, not only with NBC and covers many assignments, but also Inside the NFL on HBO, and somebody that I've always enjoyed talking with because he has a sense of reality to sports today, and I hope that you can come away with that with some of the things that he's had to say this hour. We'll take a break and continue with more of you and Sports Byline. I hope you enjoyed this special Sports Byline interview. For more interviews, visit sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr.